Yes, good morning. It's going to be a beautiful day today. 10 on the Mellish meter. Stay tuned for Kirk Mellish. Beautiful today. 66 high, low 46 tomorrow. A little more cloudy. A little more clouds. I don't even know how you say the weather. Anyway, brought to you by Shoemate Heating and Air. Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. We only have an hour today of Money Matters because of the race. It's race Sunday. I know Ryan's probably excited about that. I'll be off out and about in this beautiful Sunday. But so a lot to talk about in 1 hour today. Politics continues to trump markets, at least for now. The distraction from the race or from the GOP is fine right now. Fine for investors. Maybe that started to take away from the anxiety that so many investors felt throughout January and February. Now, as we are heading into March, we've had 2 weeks of the market's actually doing okay and having this rebound that continues up 1.5% on the week for the Dow and the S&P 500. So much to talk about in this hour of Money Matters. But because we only have an hour, let's talk about how you can call in or what maybe some of the things that have been on your mind. I'm happy to take your calls here today, and we'll start talking about, we'll take calls early on here in this Money Matters show. The number in the studio, 404-872-0750. Again, 404-872-0750. I'm your host, Wes Moss, here every Sunday morning. Well, what could your questions be about? Well, I don't know. How about a lump sum or a pension decision? Social Security. Maybe you have an annuity, you're thinking about buying an annuity, and you're scared of it, which maybe you should be, maybe you shouldn't be. How about you're ready to make a switch over to those ETFs you talk about, Wes, exchange-traded funds, and maybe it's just the allocation of how you're balanced in the world we live in. Maybe there's a vehicle that you're worried about. We had a lot of calls last weekend about various mutual funds that were supposed to be balanced, supposed to be safe, and were down 15 or 20% last year. Well, what's going on with my fund that's supposed to be balanced, supposed to be safe? And maybe there's just a financial decision that's weighing on you and kind of bugging you, and you're looking to get another opinion. So we're a lot like the Lawn and Garden Show here. You got a question about your crepe myrtle in the front yard? You want to call Walter Reeves? That's what I do. And we're just the money version of that. So we're here Sunday mornings. If you have a question about something that is bugging you when it comes to your finances or money or retirement or early retirement, hopefully, then we're the show to call in on Sunday morning. So the number here is 404-872-0750. Ryan Ely is standing by to take your call and patch it through. Or you can call us at 1-800-WSB-TALK. Now, with that, there is obviously a lot going on in the world that we live in. Another presidential debate or another GOP debate. We had South Carolina, Nevada, that was last weekend, and then Nevada this week. And Trump continues to steamroll his competition. Of course, Super Tuesday coming up in only 48 hours from now. All eyes on Super Tuesday and see if Trump's being out in the lead will just continue to stay out in the lead. And after Tuesday, if he wraps up many of those races, then it looks as though he's the presumptive nominee and everyone coalesces around him, i.e. what happened with Chris Christie. The interesting thing about politics and money, and I've always been a believer that the president himself doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the economy. And if you're going to push back on that, then you're going to also have to be willing to say, oh, Barack Obama helped the stock market go up by 200%. Barack Obama took the unemployment rate from 10 down to 4.9. No, he did not. We all know that he did not. So if we're not going to give him, you can't give him credit for that. We also can't give a president the discredit if things don't go well. The stock market is its own animal. The underlying economy is just this gigantic ocean of current that no one person can control. It's the spirit of America and entrepreneurship and ingenuity and the work ethic here in this country that really drives the economy. Does it go through cycles? Yes. Is it impacted by Washington? Yes. Is it impacted by the Fed and interest rates? All of that, yes. But still, the underlying tide and current is not just one guy in Washington. However, what is interesting, probably the most, one of the most fascinating economic, or let's call it market reports I've seen in almost 20 years, has to do with tracking companies that have the biggest lobbying presence in Washington. So if I'm a company and I know a law is going to be changed, or I'd like to impact a law to be changed in my favor so I can do an extra $5 billion in revenue, now that might actually have a big impact on the on my stock. So we do see that, and there's a study that I've been following for the last couple of years now that helps track companies that do spend a significant amount in Washington. And this, there'll be more on this in coming weeks of Money Matters. I'm just going to whet your appetite for this. But if you really track that basket of companies, not only does it do well over time, but it actually does even better than the market in general. Very difficult to ever find a strategy that's better than, or has performed better than, consistently year after year after year for 15 years than the S&P 500. But to see one of the very few strategies I've ever seen do this has to do with politics and lobbying efforts and power through the lobby in Washington, how it impacts individual companies directly. And there's, think about how expensive it is to be a to go get a lobbying firm. It's millions and millions of dollars to be able to make any sort of impact, but it has a big, it can really be a big deal when it comes to stock performance over time. So I want to just at least introduce that thought as we have a long election season ahead of us over the next year. And I'll continue to talk about this topic and how lobbying may very well impact individual companies when it comes to performance or stock price. Let's go through some of the economic highlights from this week. So we have GDP numbers, 24. So last year, 2015, we had a fourth quarter revised number. So we can see the total sum of goods and services sold or impacted in our economy. That's really the gross domestic product number, came in and revised higher last quarter to a 1% from a 0.7. So not a gangbusters number, but certainly doing well. Plenty of scary forecasts out there. If you read through Barron's this week, there are plenty of forecasts that are in titles and of articles that make it sound like the world's still falling apart at the seams. Less than zero, that's one of them. That has everything to do with interest rates going below zero. Cheap, but not a bargain. Caution flag for utilities. Just go through the first few pages of anything, and it's going to be a little bit scary. Also, the IMF this week, International Monetary Fund, they are going to lower their global forecasts because of world economic vulnerability. The reasons they cite, of course, oil, the crash in oil prices, destabilizing oil companies, financial markets, geopolitics, you name it. Still, by the way, speaking of oil, no cuts in production on the horizon. So Saudi Arabia said, remember, only a few weeks ago, that they were about to freeze oil output, at least at January levels, or at least Saudi Arabia and several other countries. But so far, there are no coordinated efforts to cut production. So we're still trying to figure out some sort of equilibrium. Remember, there's still a surplus of oil, even though demand has continued to climb. And that's one of the few things that has made it to oil hasn't gone to $10, for goodness sakes. We're hovering around $32, $33 today, all the way down from $100 a barrel. But the reason we haven't cratered all the way down to $10 is that as the price of oil has crashed and come down, we're using more of it. So we're driving more, we're fueling power plants with more fossil fuel because it's less and less and less expensive. You're less worried about buying a Tahoe today than you were 2 years ago when gas was $4 a gallon, headed to $5 a gallon. I was at Kroger the other day, where a friend of mine texted me from, I think it was the Costco in the Dunwoody area, $1.65 a gallon. I was at Kroger using my Kroger Plus card. Now, we'd spent a lot at Kroger, so I had a lot of cents off per gallon. But with my Kroger Plus card and the discount I got, using it all in one fill-up, I had premium gas for, I want to say it was $1.01. A dollar and a penny for premium gas. So pretty remarkable what's happened to gas prices. Now, that all leads back to one very important concept. And the biggest worry this year, as the market has corrected, and it's gotten better in the last couple of weeks, but as it corrected, we are worried that, hey, this 15% pullback that is an official correction, 10% plus, does it turn into a bear market? Does it turn into a 25, 35% correction? And it goes from painful to devastating for some. And the answer here lies in what's the underlying bedrock doing, meaning does the economy stay out of recession or not? Because we know historically, time and time again, that corrections stay corrections for the most part if the underlying economy doesn't crumble. Sure, the stock market as an animal always has froth in one direction or the other. Maybe it's overvalued by 15% or undervalued by 15%. But when the market's correct on the downside and then the economy is headed into recession, those corrections turn into pretty nasty bear markets. And that's why the focus here on Money Matters for so many months now has been, hey, are we going to stay out of a economic recession or not? And so far, as we continue to see the totality of economic data, we're staying out of recession. This week, again, GDP still up for the fourth quarter. We saw consumer spending go up this week. We had a report on consumer spending. We saw inflation tick up a little bit. We saw wages tick up a little bit. So far, the totality of economic evidence tells us that we are still not going into recession, at least anytime soon. When we get back from quick news weather traffic, we will go to the phones and take your phone calls and questions, 404-872-0750. 1-800-WSB-TALK. You are listening to Money Matters. I'm your host, Wes Moss, here every Sunday morning. Today, 9 to 10, usually 9 to 11. And more Money Matters straight.
Now back to Wes Moss with the money and investing advice you need.
Well, good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Let's go right to the phones here. Scott joins us from Lilburn. Scott, good morning. Welcome to the show. Can we help?
Good morning, Wes. I have a basic question that I've always been wondering about. It affects my investments, and I'm sure everybody else's. And it's how when I was young, I saw the Dow start at like 700 points, and now it's at 17,000 or 16,000. I don't understand how it works. How is that calculated, and how does that affect my portfolio? And why am I not a gazillionaire? You know what I mean?
I've always been fascinated to the Dow Jones is a fascinating animal, if you will, and it's pretty simple, and it actually is different from most other indexes that are based upon the size of company. So the S&P 500 is based on the size. So the bigger the company market cap, the bigger the weight it has in the Dow or the S&P 500. The Dow uniquely is price weighted, which is interesting, meaning that the price of the stock, a $150 stock, has way more impact than a $30 stock. So that makes it kind of unique, and that seems as though there's some sort of, that doesn't seem overly relevant if you were to have a stock that is $1,000 a share, like a Berkshire versus a much lower price company. But Dow Jones as a committee makes sure that companies have stock prices in the same range so that one isn't overly impactful. And that's why it took a long time for Apple to get into the index, and they had to do a reverse split, lower their price to get there. Pretty simply, the Dow Jones just adds up all 30 companies from a price at the end of the day or every second of the day. And then there's a divisor for it. And it just divides out. And every time there's a dividend or a stock split, that divisor changes to give you the level of the Dow. And that's how it's calculated. The reason I like the Dow, and I think it's more representative than people give it credit for, is that there's no sector, except for maybe utilities, that isn't represented. So you've got Staples, Procter & Gamble, Healthcare, Pfizer and Merck. You've got telecom with Verizon, DuPont for materials, Exxon and Chevron for energy, Disney and Nike for discretionary, financials like Goldman and American Express, technology like Apple. So it's got every sector, which actually gives it a lot of credence, and it's actually more representative than most people give it credit for. Hey, more Money Matters right here on WSB straight ahead.
Now, here's more great money and investment advice from certified financial planner Wes Moss.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here. The number in the studio, 404-872-0750. You know what the weather's like today? It's a 10 on the Mellish meter, by the way. 66, a high, low 46, sunny, period. Of course, tune in tomorrow morning for more Kirk Mellish forecasts brought to you by Shoemate Heating and Air. I actually get the text message now every morning. It's on the weekdays. I don't get it on the weekends, but every morning I get the Mellish meter level texted to my phone. I love that. Kirk Mellish is probably the coolest guy in the world, too, by the way. Anyway, we've got phone calls on hold. We're going to get to them right now. 404-872-0750. Economic numbers continue to come in. I call them good, not great. But they continue to the totality of the economic evidence. If I go through my CHIME acronym, consumer spending and consumer confidence, housing, inflation and interest rates, manufacturing and employment slash earnings, that's my acronym. My acronym to remember the big headline economic numbers that really matter. By the way, we have a jobs number coming up this Friday, which will be the first Friday in March. So we'll get jobs for February. That number is probably going to be around 200,000, like we've seen in a lot of the past months. So if we continue to add jobs at this level, we'll keep the unemployment rate around 4.9, maybe even lower. And we're starting to see wages pick up a little bit. And that's when we could start to see a little bit of inflation. So that's something to really keep an eye on, because if that happens, then we'll see the Fed start raising rates. The Fed meets again and ends their meeting, which is really important, when they announce what they're going to do with rates. That comes out March 16th. So a couple weeks from today, the Fed will have its next announcement. Odds are, as far as the futures markets are concerned, it's a 95% chance that they're not going to do anything again, and that's fine. But if we continue to see wages heat up and inflation pick up and unemployment continue to trickle lower from the level that we are at today, then the Fed's going to have to start raising rates again or do something, as opposed to just sit there. Now, it's a little bit easier for them to sit where they are today with the thought of negative interest rates around the world. Japan has negative interest rates. If you go to Germany and you go to look at Europe, European interest rates are virtually flat or zero to negative, even for long-term bonds, even for a 10-year bond. You're getting fluctuating between slightly negatives and slightly positive. So it's a fascinating interest rate environment around the world. And that, of course, impacts what the Fed's going to do. So we're going to continue to keep an eye on that, because remember, the reason we've had such a focus on the economy in the last several months is that as the headline volatility in the stock market continues to worry people, we can still feel confident and comfortable if we know that the economy at least is going to stay out of recession. Then if we can just, as investors, be diligent enough and disciplined enough to own high quality companies that pay dividends and high quality companies that issue bonds, and we own both of those, then we shouldn't be worried even when we do go through corrections. They're normal, they're natural, they're painful, yes, but natural. And historically, that's part of the pain of being an investor. If it's that easy, then how are you gonna make a compounded 11% a year for the last 100 years? And yes, by the way, that is the number. It doesn't feel like that, you don't remember that number, if you go back 100 years and you were a diligent investor and a patient investor, then yes, and you were all stock-based, then we're talking about double-digit returns. That can't be easy. It's not something that everybody has the stomach for, or else it wouldn't be such a high premium for the risk and reward you get. And that's part of the game and part of the long-term. It is the Ironman triathlon, not a sprint, of being an investor. 404-872-0750. Michelle joins us from Atlanta. Hey, Michelle. Hello. Good morning. Welcome to the show. Hi. What's going on?
I just have two questions. The first one has to do with the fact that I read a lot about, you know, the whole compound interest theory. However, I'm not sure where you're supposed to realize this theory. I mean, where is it that you can get like a consistent, like, for example, if I read something that says, oh, your money's, you know, if you kept it for 20 years at 5%, this is what it would be. But is there a such thing as a way to get a consistent rate of return that really is representative of this compound interest theory?
So, yeah, I think that, okay, let me pull this apart a little bit here. Michelle, because I think you're so compounding in general is used very often when it comes to investing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the famous, I don't know if it was Einstein or Ben Franklin or whoever it was, I think it's Einstein, that said the most powerful force in the universe is compounding. So compounding is really a mathematical principle. It's a principle mm-hmm. that applies to anything. It's just a mathematical principle. It's not specific to investing. Now, it is extremely evident when it comes to being an investor, but think of the principle itself. That's just math. It's just a snowball. Think of a snowball rolling down a hill. When it's in the beginning stages of rolling down the hill, and it turns and turns and turns as it gets bigger. 5% on a little snowball, not a big deal. 5% on a gigantic snowball barreling down the mountain. Is a gigantic amount, right? So 10% rate of return when I'm Bill Gates and I have 40 billion, now I've got 44 billion. I just made $4 billion. By the way, he's more like 80 billion. If I have 40,000, 10% doesn't move the meter on a nominal basis all that much, right? So compounding and the rich get richer, it's because 10% on a billion is a huge number relative to 10% on 100,000. So compounding is this. It's really just a mathematical principle. It happens to be very, very. It's a very important principle when it comes to being an investor. So there's no such, even though it's commonly referred to when it comes to investing, there's no particular strategy or account that says, oh, this is the compounding strategy that you've been looking for all these years.
Okay, I was just wondering, because I always read about it, and I'm like, okay, where the heck is this? Where can I find it? But thank you so much for explaining that. And this is my last final question. I'm going to let you get to your other callers. But is there such thing as a diversified ETF? Because we know that, you know, whenever one sector goes down, then all of them go down. And if you, the ETFs I have, I mean, they are of a particular sector. And I'm kind of leery about that. So I was wondering, is there such thing as a diversified ETF?
Well, of course. Now, it used to be that there were only a few. So go back about 20, almost 30 years now. And the first ETFs were just broad indices. So it was just the S&P 500, which is to this day, I still think SPY, Ryan, you might want to check me on this one. But I think SPY, which is the original Standard & Poor's 500 ETF, I think that's still the biggest ETF on the planet. But what's happened is the mechanics of an ETF have evolved and gotten more popular, and they're easier to create. They've gotten more and more and more specific. So if you own an S&P 500 ETF, Michelle, you own the whole market, and to your point, you own every sector. Then they evolved to sector ETFs, and I had my staples and healthcare and utilities and telecom and energy and materials, and I could get a sector in each, an ETF for each one. And then I remember this happening probably 15 years ago, they started to get ultra specific. So then healthcare would have a pharmaceutical ETF that only focused in on drugs that helped with dermatology or drugs that dealt with cancer. And then they went even further. So companies that did that, then they went even further. And I remember ETFs that were drug companies that focus on specific kinds of cancer. So we got to the point where ETFs started in this really broad categorization to becoming these micro hyper-focused ETFs. So now an ETF is just, we've got to be careful because ETF is just a vehicle. An exchange-traded fund is just a vehicle to buy stocks, bonds, commodities, whatever you want to buy. They have evolved over the years to get really darn specific. So in the world that we, in fact, I want to say that I just read this week in the Wall Street Journal that Franklin Templeton, a gigantic traditional mutual fund company, has just filed for one of their strategies, actively managed strategies, by the way, not passive like most ETFs are, to have one of their mutual fund strategies now be carried out in an ETF. So they're going to be evidently just a diversified mutual fund, except it's going to be in an ETF. So the lines have become, the lines have completely blurred. It used to be there was a actively managed mutual funds and passive ETFs. And now there are tons of both, meaning there are active and passive mutual funds, and there are active and passive ETFs, and you can get as specific or broad as you want. Now, my opinion, what I think you should go look at.
What do you mean when you say active? Are you saying that, active meaning that you self-trade or a company actually manages this portfolio?
Right. So big dip. So think about the S&P 500 as an ETF. There's no person or manager or research team in there buying and selling, because all that ETF does is own the 500 companies that happen to be in the S&P at any given time. So there's no research going on. It's just mechanical.
All right.
What typically or historically mutual funds are trying to do is they're trying to outperform the benchmark or the S&P 500. So you've got a manager and a team of research analysts that are buying and selling within that fund to try to outperform the market.
Okay.
So that's active versus passive. You're just owning whatever's in the index. What's happened in the world we live in today is that there's complete crossover now. And so now as an investor, you've got to be really, you've got to understand what kind of ETF you own. Is it active? Is it passive? Is it stocks? Is it bonds? And by the way, Ryan just confirmed the SPY is it's the S&P 500. It's the largest ETF in the world, $170 billion. Another thought here, and this goes back to, and Michelle, by the way, thank you for your question. Another adding on to what this question about compounding, even though there's no specific place to get it, if you will. The other rule I love as an investor has to do with the rule of 72. So the rule of 72, it's just like, it's really kind of just a mathematical shortcut to estimate the number of years it takes to double your money at any given rate of return. So as a rule, it states that you divide the rate expressed as a percentage into 72. So how long does it take to double your money at 7.2%? Well, 7.2 divided by into 72 is 10. It takes 10 years. Or it takes, if you get 10% rate of return, it takes 7.2% or 7.2 years to double your money. Really helpful way to start thinking about the power of getting a steady rate of return. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be that steady. It's just if you have an average rate of return of 5 or 6 or 7%, your money's going to double in 10, 11, 12 years. And that's a powerful mathematic formula to always keep in the back of your mind. That's a big part of why we're doing this to begin with. That's a big part of why we're investing to begin with. So, Michelle, that was a great call. And we got off on a complete mathematical investment tangent, but I think it was a worthwhile discussion. Again, you are listening to Money Matters. If you want to find me and the Money Matters team, go to my website, wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com, or yourwealth.com. More Money Matters right here on WSB straight ahead. Welcome back to Money Matters. I guess the Oscars are tonight. I don't usually watch them, but everyone's nodding their head. The Oscars are tonight. This is amazing to me. If you think about the last time you went to a trade show, think about the tchotchkes you got. So last time we went to like a race, or I think of like the Atlanta half, the Thanksgiving Day half marathon, I got a gift bag. And basically it wasn't even a gift bag. When I picked up my bib, I got a free shirt, which was great. And I love free t-shirts. And then, if you've been to an event or a conference and you get those giveaways, think about the giveaways you get. Maybe it's a t-shirt, maybe it's a long sleeve tee if it's really good. Or one of those foamy spongy elephants or lobsters, I don't know. Or a keychain, or most of the time I get like a broken pen. Here's what you're getting if you're an Oscar nominee in your gift bag. So you'd get a 10-day first class trip to Israel. It's valued at $55,000. 15 days to Japan. First class, $54,000. Silver car. I guess they rent luxury cars. I've never even heard of silver car, but I guess this is why they did that, because now people are talking about it on air. Free unlimited Audi, as in the car, Audis, rentals for a year. I don't know what that's worth, probably $30,000. For the female nominees, there's something called a vampire breast lift, which I've never even heard of before, which is invented by the same guy who invented the same doctor who invented the vampire facelift. I guess that's a real thing. And then another $5,500 in other plastic surgery vouchers. This is in the Oscar gift bag for nominees. Unbelievable. So the in 2014, the Oscar tchotchke gift bags, if you will, valued at $85,000. Last year valued at $168,000. This is just a bag of stuff you get when you go. Again, if you're a nominee, I guess. And then this year, value on the Oscar gift bags, $232,000. Almost $250,000 in your gift bag. Unbelievable. Anyway, there's a lot happening, obviously, coming up this week. We've got kind of the biggest thought, the biggest economic number will be Friday, the February employment report. That we get a release for that, anywhere from 175 to about 200,000. Those are the economic forecasts when it comes to jobs. Jobs Friday coming up. Of course, we've got earnings still that will be trickling throughout the week, but it's all about jobs this week and economic numbers that we'll be watching. Enjoy Oscar Sunday. Enjoy the race straight ahead. And we're here for the rest of the day serving you right here on WSB.